Hi, and welcome to the Psychology Sisters podcast.
Just two besties on a quest to normalise the dialogue around mental health. I'm Kat, a registered psychologist.
And I'm Amy, a registered psychotherapist. In our episodes, we combine our skills, professional and personal experiences with a light sprinkling of science and a dabble of fun to help you to become informed, in control and empowered.
Now let's dive deep into today's episode. Hello, everybody.
Woo-hoo.
Welcome back to another episode. Not really sure what number we're up to. You know, when you're in your 20s and you're not sure what number you are in your 20s, you don't know how exactly old you are, but you just know when you're in your 20s.
Yeah.
That's how I feel like with these episodes. I'm like, we're kind of in the...
Or you're not sure what day of the week is. Like, you've just had one of those weeks where all the days roll into one.
Yeah.
And you're like, did I do that on Tuesday?
Yeah.
No, was it Thursday?
Yeah.
One of the tea days.
What day is it today? Yeah. So welcome back to another episode of whatever number it is. Today we are talking all things imposter syndrome, but before we get a little into it, Amy, how was your week?
My week has been fabulous. I've had a great week, been super busy, and that was going to be one of my things. I was going to try to say that
you're busy, but you are really busy. I know for a fact that you are absolutely running to the ground at the moment. And can you please tell everyone what you're doing tomorrow?
Okay, so tomorrow it's kind of a pit and a peak. So the pit is that I thought I was going to be doing another half marathon. So I have just been gorging myself on food, being like,
carb loading.
Oh, it doesn't matter. I'm going to be doing a half marathon. I'll burn it all off.
You love
carb
your marathons.
Loading. Yeah.
Can't
like,
stop.
Oh, I just eat whatever I want because I'm doing a half marathon. So YOLO. Went to register for the half marathon. Registrations were closed. So I basically just consumed about 2 or 3 times worth of the weekly calorie intake that I should have to run a measly 10Ks.
Measly 10Ks. 10Ks is still super hard, but carb loading, it's a thing.
It's a, yeah, well.
I mean, you'll probably be the fastest runner there.
Carb loading is actually a myth. Fun fact out
is
there.
It?
Unless you're doing like a marathon or something
like,
you know,
extreme.
Yeah, carb loading's not really a thing, hey.
I remember I did a triathlon and I carb loaded. And
we did together and we ate like a bowl of potatoes.
And we didn't need it.
We really
remember?
Didn't need it.
We were still like, that wasn't that bad. We
I
didn't
just felt
need
it. Heavy.
Yeah.
So it was harder to
It actually made it worse. So
they actually just say eat your normal amount of calories, just adjust the macronutrient variables. So you might just, you know, eat 10% more carbs than usual.
Is that all?
That's all.
Oh, isn't that disappointing?
Yeah. And they actually say have an early dinner the night before a half marathon or a marathon, and it should just be something normal that you eat that's easy to digest.
Where's the fun in that? Did you do the marathon just so you could eat like...
Yeah, pretty much. It was just an excuse to eat loads of food and now I can't even do it. So I basically just got fat.
You should just turn around and do.
So my peak is that I ate heaps of delicious food.
Delicious food, yeah.
And my pit is that I'm not able to do the Baltimore City Running Festival half marathon. Yeah.
Oh my gosh, I think you're absolutely not so.
So what's your pit and peak? How's your week been? Enough about me. More about you. What's going on?
Right,
talk to me.
I have like been saving this story up. I saw you a few days ago and I didn't tell you this story because I wanted your organic response.
Can I just say to all of our listeners, this is starting to affect our relationship because Kat is withholding vital information from me to get my candid reaction for the podcast. So you should
I'm doing this for you guys.
You should feel very special.
So I'm going to have to... I retold this story with action, so I'm going to have to describe it because I only have a microphone. Okay, so I had a pretty big pit this week. It's kind of funny now that I look back on it, but the day was – I had probably the most mortifying experience of my whole entire life. And that's a big call because
worse
I'm –
than blood and shoe?
Oh, actually, you know what? I would say on par. And I'm a pretty mortifying person. I do a lot of things wrong. I trip over in public a lot. I'm just an embarrassment already. So for me to say this is a huge deal. So I was driving along and down the side of my car, that's just where I keep my red lipstick. I don't know why, but that's just where I keep. Anyway, for some reason, someone had cleaned my car last week and they must have accidentally opened the lipstick. I've got a glass water bottle. So I had put in the glass water bottle on top of the like lipstick that was out of its case. Does that make sense? So it was out like a naked lipstick in the wild and I put my glass water bottle on it, right? And it squished it. It's like squish it and I hadn't noticed it this time. I want you to know now that I was wearing white pants. Like never wear white pants. I'm just gonna, I know they look cool and that you look like European. No, just don't do it. So I've gotten the water bottle out of the side pocket. Had not noticed because I was driving. I was driving, drinking my water. Hadn't noticed there was red lipstick smeared underneath the water bottle. I've put it on my leg. Like, I've just, you know, rested on my leg.
I see where this is going. Yeah.
I get to my work and I'm like, look down. I'm like, oh, shit. There is a big, like, red circle on my leg. I was like, jeez. Anyway, so without thinking, I've gotten out of the car and I've put the water bottle on my car seat. And I've been like, just not knowing what to do. I was like flapping around. I was like, oh geez, work frazzled. Starts in 10 minutes. I was so frazzled. I was like, I don't know what to do. People are going to think I'm like an idiot with my white pants and my red stain. Okay. But it wasn't in a compromising position at the front of my leg. It just looked like red paint or something like that. A water bottle's just chilling on the car seat. I'm going around trying to just work out what the fuck to do. Look like a crazy chicken. I pick the water bottle back up off my car seat. And I sit down on my car seat. Like, I don't know why. I sat down because I was freaking out what to do. So I had to sit down and take a breath. Sat down. I think I rubbed, like, my leg with, like, baby wipes, like, makeup remover. Yeah. Tried to get it off. Didn't come off. Anyway, so I've stood back up and I'm like, oh, shit, okay. I'm just going to have to go in and just explain to people that, no, this is not anything. It's just red lipstick. So what I haven't realized is I've sat in the place where my water bottle was, which is on a pile of lipstick that had shaped, like that had like fallen off when I've put the water bottle on the seat.
Yeah.
So for 6 hours from 9 a.m. until 2:30 p.m., I have walked around with the – I'm going to show you a picture.
Love that you have a picture.
With the biggest red patch on my butt. It looked like I actually had my period.
Don't lie, you just got your period.
Like white pants and in the worst spot, right? It wasn't even in. Oh
God, it's not even a little bit either.
No, it's a lot.
It's like a giant, big.
It's all my lipstick stain. Had gone onto my butt.
Wow.
And it looked.
Great butt though.
So bad. Hadn't realized that it looked like I had bled.
It looks like you just. Got your period for the
exactly
first time.
Exactly. So I go into the bathroom at 2:30 and I'm like, oh God, I'm so stupid. I got lipstick on the front of my leg, like telling everyone, like, ah, oh, this idiot. Nobody.
They probably thought that was a cover up for getting your period. They were probably like, oh, yes, Kat, lipstick.
Because I'm such an awkward
person. They probably thought
person.
You got your period and then you got your lipstick and rubbed it on the front of your pants, like, oh, what a mistake I've made.
I know. And it sounded so guilty because I was like, I swear it's lipstick because I knew that everybody would be thinking that it's not. So I even looked guilty, but that's just who I am as a person.
You haven't even realized.
I hadn't realized it's on the back of my pants. I had walked around all day. I'd strutted around, like talked to so many different people. I felt just defeated. It wasn't even embarrassment. I was like,
this is my life now.
This is my life. I got home that afternoon and I was like, psychologist jobs can't work here anymore. So it was the most mortifying day of my life. Like 6.5 hours I've walked around with a red lipstick in the most uncompromising position. So that is my pit and it was.
It's a pretty big pit.
Look at that. Look at that picture.
It looks like your ovaries just exploded all over your white pants.
White pants.
Okay, what about a peach?
Nothing can save me.
The morale?
No, actually, the day after, I was feeling really sorry for myself and I just felt like a sad. You know when a dog farts and they're really shamed? That's how I felt the day after.
You stinky dog.
I didn't want to look anyone in the eye. You know how dogs don't look people in the eye when they've done something wrong?
Yeah.
I was like that. I was like, don't look me in the eye. I don't talk to anybody. It's so embarrassing. Aww. The day after, I actually did a. I did a presentation and it went really, really well. So,
oh, yay!
That's my little.
What was your presentation on?
It was on self-esteem and confidence.
Did you wear black pants?
Yes. I was black everything. I looked like I was in mourning. I was black, 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 black. And ever since then, I've been wearing black because I'm so petrified. I will never wear white again. I'll never love again.
One day you'll wear white again.
I'll never laugh again. So, yeah, that was my week. And I'm sorry that this has taken so long, this pit in the peak.
I needed to hear that. Today we are going to be talking about the psychological phenomenon known as imposter syndrome.
Have you ever felt like you're a fraud? Like you start a new job and you feel like you absolutely do not belong there and at any time someone's going to come in and find out that you actually don't belong there and you're super underqualified. This is what we call the imposter syndrome and it is so common. I read a stat and I think it's about 50% of women and 50% of men roughly suffer or have suffered the imposter syndrome at
any stage of their life. And it's not just younger people, it's, you know, really prevalent amongst older people as well. So, Amy, have you ever suffered from the imposter syndrome?
I definitely have. It's like this nagging doubt you haven't earned your accomplishments. Yes. It's like, I don't deserve to be here. I just got here out of sheer luck.
Mm.
And the name kind of sounds like an Alfred Hitchcock movie. It's like, oh, the imposter syndrome.
Mm.
But it's not actually a syndrome as such. It's not a disability. It's kind of like you were saying, it's as common as the flu.
Mm.
I read an article that said about 70% of us actually experience this feeling of fraudulence at some point of time, especially if you are working in an environment around highly successful people that you're comparing yourself to, or even at uni. You know, I remember when I was at uni, just thinking how intelligent everyone around me was and how they knew so much more than I did, and how did I get to be here? They must have screwed up the test results in some exam and I just, you know, got here by accident.
You feel
like
you don't deserve to be there.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's this pushback to achievements having anything to do with you and your talent or your skill, and it's this feeling of phoniness, like we've snuck into success and we shouldn't be there, and at any moment the bouncer is going to come and be like, you fraud, get out of here.
No, it's like they do a background search and they haven't found you yet, and you're just waiting for someone to come in and be like, we know that you're not supposed to be here, and take you away all the time. So uni is where you kind of felt it a little bit.
Uni, and when I left uni and entered the workforce as well.
So the last 10 years of your life.
I just remember feeling so just like,
100%. Yeah. And I find with uni as well, I felt that pretty much every single day in my uni life. The other people probably feel just as scared as you do, and they feel just as impostery as you do, but nobody talks about it. And nobody, so you think that everybody is so smart. And I feel like there are those people in class at uni who put up their hand because they love the sound of their own voice and they love to show off a little bit. And that makes everybody else feel so uncomfortable because they're thinking, I need to be at that level of intellect and I'm not. How do they know so much? What is wrong with me?
Yeah.
Little do they know that pretty much everybody else, 70% of people in that room, feel exactly the same way.
Yes, there's this thing called pluralistic ignorance, which is where everyone doubts themselves privately. So we all think we're alone in feeling this way because nobody else ever voices or verbalizes their own feelings of self-doubt. Yes. So we're all just sitting there in our uni classes thinking, oh my God, everyone's so smart. Everyone knows things I don't know.
Like,
I don't deserve to be here. Yes. I'm not as smart. I don't have the skill. You know, like I might have got through the exams this year, but oh gosh, next year I'm not going to be so lucky.
Yeah, it's like I found it really hard this year. What about next year? They're only just going to get harder.
Yeah.
100%. And I also felt that the second time I ever felt it, a big wave of it was obviously starting my first job after uni.
Mm.
So I'm qualified, I'm ready to go into the workforce, and it's like, oh my God, how did I do this? I don't not belong here. I'm surrounded by people who are very intelligent and know what they're doing and have been there for a long time. Mm. I'm new. I'm fresh. What am I doing? I don't know how to do this job.
100%. And I feel that way as well because everybody looks at you for our degree, for our qualifications. Everyone looks at you as the mental health expert. Yes. Like, you're the expert. Please guide us.
Yeah. There's a lot of pressure and responsibility.
A lot of pressure.
Yeah.
And it's imposter syndrome is kind of characterized by these underlying feelings of anxiety, perfectionism, self-doubt and fear. So, and I'm sure everyone at some stage of their life would have experienced self-doubt because it's the human condition.
Mm.
You know, we doubt ourselves in many different aspects of our lives.
Yes.
But especially when it comes to our career, just that feeling of doubting yourself and your skills and, you know, how you got to be in this position of expertise.
Yeah, yeah. Like, and that's the thing.
Yeah.
When you step out of uni or you step out of a course or you start a whole new job that you pretty much have zero experience in. But I think also what makes this worse is that a lot of people on their resume will pump up what they think that they know. Like, that's what we're taught, you know, just look like you've done a lot more than what you actually have. So they go in and they might already have that expectation that they need to know a lot more than what they actually do. And especially when you are someone who's a little bit younger or you're just starting a new job, that feeling is so overwhelming because you look at everybody around you and you think, I do not deserve to be here.
I don't belong.
I do not belong here. When are they going to find out that I'm actually a fraud and I actually can't do this job? So in your first few days, you're probably so riddled, overwhelmed. Exactly. First few days, first few months, really. It's like...
First couple of years.
happening. Yeah, it's like, I do not belong here. You get really anxious. You feel really worried. And you feel like... nothing you do is good enough because you feel you already have this high expectation that you can never reach, because sometimes when you're in a new job, that skill and expertise comes through experience. And unfortunately, as someone who's starting a job, you don't have much experience. And I think that also being younger can also make you look more vulnerable to this, because people might look at you like, what do you know? And it's almost like you need to constantly
prove yourself.
And it really adds to that anxiety as well.
Definitely. And even Albert Einstein described himself as an involuntary swindler because he believed he didn't deserve the attention he received. So it just goes to show that
no matter how high achieving you are, guarantee that you will feel this way in some stage of your life.
Definitely. And there's no easy way to dismiss feelings that we're less capable of other people around us. And it's human nature to compare yourself, especially to the colleagues that are working closely with you and around you. And when you are surrounded by really high achieving and successful people, I think it's natural to get these feelings of imposterism where, you know, it might even stop you from applying for career opportunities and sharing ideas out of fear that you're unworthy of your position, or you don't have the same skills or the same intelligence as other people. And that can kind of be really anxiety provoking. I remember reading that there was the psychologist Pauline Rose Clance was the first to study this kind of unjustified sense of insecurity, on this belief that we don't deserve our place in our work. When she started looking at the university students that she was working with, and a lot of them believed that they had been there due to some kind of admissions error, like they were there by mistake, even though they were really extremely intelligent, highly successful students. So she discovered that this is common across gender, age, race, and a range of occupations. And she also kind of discusses that even the term syndrome makes it sound like an illness or a disease, when it isn't. It's a universal feeling that most of us will experience, and it's not an abnormality. So while it can provoke these feelings of anxiety, it's not necessarily linked to anxiety, depression, or even self-esteem. So yeah, I just thought that was really
interesting. And it's also, I've noticed in the research that I've done with imposter syndrome, is it tends to be more prevalent among certain personality traits. So, for example...
Perfectionist.
Yeah, there was an author called Valerie Young, and she wrote The Secret Thoughts of Successful Women. And she suggested that there are five personality types that do tend to fall into the imposter syndrome trap. So, for example, as you said, the perfectionists set extremely high expectations for themselves. And even if they meet 99% of their goals, they're still going to feel like a failure. If they get 99 out of 100, they're still going to feel like a failure. Any small mistake will make a perfectionist question their own competence. So while they might have done 99 things correctly, if they did one thing incorrectly, that's what they will focus on.
Definitely. So they believe that any little flaw will reveal their incompetence.
And it will keep perpetuating and continuing the cycle of anxiety and the core belief of, I don't deserve to be here because look at me, I'm making mistakes. It's confirming their original thoughts that I don't deserve to be here.
Yeah. It's like having a mean person sitting on your shoulder telling you awful things like, oh, you did it this time.
See, I told you.
Lucky next time.
Exactly.
These people are smarter than you.
Yeah. The second personality trait that Valerie Young suggested was there are people who feel like they are experts, and I know so many of these. Experts feel the need to know every single little piece of information. Actually, I think, Ames, this is a little bit you, before they start a project and constantly look for new certifications or trainings to improve their skills. They won't apply for a job if they don't meet all the criteria in the posting, and they might be hesitant to ask a question in class or speak up in a meeting because they're afraid of looking stupid if they don't already know the answer. People who think that feel like they are a natural genius. They feel like they need to work really, really hard and accomplish something. And if they don't, that means that they're not good enough.
That was definitely me and you.
Yeah.
I used to be like, oh, I don't study. I'm just, naturally gifted. Oh,
and
a biopsychologist from birth.
They are used to skills coming easily. And when they have to put in effort, their brain tells them that that's proof that they're an imposter. So if you're someone who has, is lucky enough to be a natural, in quotes, genius, and you've, you know, never really had to try really hard, then if you do start to try really hard, or you need to learn a new skill set, or you know you are starting a new job, there is a lot to learn. And of course, you're not going to know everything. And if you don't know something because you haven't been conditioned, or you haven't had the experience of not knowing something, you would take that as, oh, maybe I can't do this. Maybe I find this really hard, and therefore I mustn't be good at it, and therefore I must be an imposter. What am I doing here? Soloists are another one. Soloists feel like they have to accomplish tasks on their own, and if they need to ask for help, they think that that means they're a failure or a fraud. Oh man, preach it. This is definitely me. So people who do things on their own and like to think that they've got it all on their own, and independent women or men, they will find it really hard to ask for help. And if they have to, they will feel like that they have failed or they are a fraud, further perpetuating their belief that they are an imposter. Do you ever feel like that?
No.
As a soloist? Yeah. We're listening to each of these being like, yep, yep. Okay, the last one. If you are someone who is a superwoman or a superman, so you are someone who pushes yourself to work harder than anyone else around you to prove that you're not an imposter.
Little workaholic.
Yes. You feel the need to succeed in all aspects of life, at work, as a student, as parents, as partners, as a friend, and may feel stressed when you are not accomplishing something. And any little thing that you don't accomplish perpetuates the idea that you are an imposter and you do not belong in any of those roles.
I definitely feel like that. And I feel like the issue with that is you don't know, or you don't feel like there's a boundary when to stop working. So it's this, you don't know when you're working too hard, or you don't know when you're doing too much, because there's no such thing as doing too much work.
Exactly. Exactly.
You just want to keep working.
You can do as much work as you can, which might end in burnout, exhaustion,
overwhelmed.
Feeling overwhelmed. And then imagine if that happened and you feel like you can never work enough to achieve the level that you want to achieve, and you are burnt out and you're exhausted. If that happens, then of course you're going to think to yourself, see, I'm not good enough. Like, I couldn't even handle that job or that uni qualification, or I couldn't handle being a mum. Like, kind of everything
reinforces what you believe.
Yeah, and it really is setting you up. It's a bit of a trap, isn't it, the imposter syndrome?
Imposter is a trap.
So who feels the imposter syndrome? There is no gender difference. Men feel the imposter syndrome just as much as women, and at all stages of their life. So if you are someone who feels like you are kind of stuck in a bit of the imposter syndrome, it is completely normal. I 100% can tell you that it is so normal. And I think with a lot of the clients that we see, speaking for myself, everybody feels like that. Most people feel like they do not belong, and they feel like they've tried really hard, and it doesn't matter how hard they try, they feel like they can never be as good as their colleagues or their friends or whoever else they're comparing themselves to. So imposter syndrome is so normal among so many people.
It's a universal feeling. Some of the causes of imposter syndrome can stem from the environment in which we develop in. So exposure to alcoholism, abuse, whether that be verbal or physical, or any significant conflict, such as relentless or consistent criticism from childhood, can kind of create this feeling of not being good enough or being unworthy or constantly needing to prove yourself because you feel incompetent. So imposter syndrome can be a response from trauma, from lived experience. For example, a child who has grown up with, say, an alcoholic, verbally abusive parent who may be really successful in their career and like providing financial security, but who constantly criticizes and berates that child for being incompetent. Say they might get 85% in an exam and their parent might say, well, where's the other 15%? So that feeling of not being good enough and constantly having to prove yourself, that child will develop this need to prove themselves. However, that rarely happens because they believe they'll never be good enough, and any kind of positive feedback they get, they still just don't believe they're worthy. So imposter syndrome can develop after happy childhoods as well. For example, adults that work in occupations that have consistent critiquing. So like that can be anything from corporate CEOs to artists and musicians that constantly get criticism. These feelings come from successful people who are highly skilled and tend to compare themselves and think others are just as skilled or more skilled as them, which can cascade into feelings that they don't belong in the position they're in. And these feelings of being an imposter or a fraud is what I was talking about. Pluralistic ignorance can be a category of imposterism, as everyone's just kind of sitting there thinking, I'm not good enough, I don't deserve to be here. You start to doubt yourself and think that everyone else around you has more skills than you or is more qualified than you, but you don't voice those doubts.
Nobody talks about it.
Yeah. So how do we kick feeling like a phony? Talk about it. Many people experiencing imposter syndrome feel that they, if they voice their doubts or their fears, that they'll be confirmed. And positive feedback usually fails to ease feelings of fraudulence. So hearing a manager or an advisor say, you're doing a great job, doesn't usually tend to ease those feelings of fraudulence.
I remember reading a really cool study where they had, they were investigating, you know how like at work everyone has got a supervisor or a manager or something like that. And they found that over 80% of the time, supervisors spend that time reassuring and validating that that person is doing a good job and that they deserve to be there. Isn't that interesting? So it's not critiquing their work. It's saying, yes, you're doing a really good job. You don't need to stress.
Yeah, so reassuring them. And isn't it interesting that that often falls on deaf ears for people who are feeling like frauds? But actually what they have found is that hearing a manager or an advisor say that they've experienced the same doubts can help relieve feelings of fraudulence. So if you hear that one of your peers or someone in a higher position than you has been like, yeah, I feel like that too, I have no idea what I'm doing, that can often alleviate some of those feelings of maybe not feeling worthy or not feeling like you deserve to be there. So once you're aware of your own imposter syndrome, collecting positive feedback can be helpful then. One scientist started documenting the cause of every time something went wrong in her experiment and realized the issues weren't to be blamed on herself or her incompetence, but on her equipment failure. So that was really helpful for her once she understood that she was dealing with imposter syndrome, to then kind of look at the evidence and...
It wasn't her, it was her own self-blame.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't actually anything to do with her, it was mostly the external circumstances that were causing these mistakes to happen. And I think that's so common in imposter syndrome. I mean, we tend to think of every little mistake that maybe colleagues make or people in our team make and think, oh my God, that's my fault. I shouldn't have done that. I should have done that differently. And that can really go back to unhelpful thinking styles. I mean, if you're someone who does self-blame, or you're a black and white thinker, or you're a catastrophizer, or you're
a perfectionist,
or jumping to conclusions, that really feeds into you feeling like you have imposter syndrome, because you're trying to find the little mistakes and make them personalized as if like it was your fault. And that further perpetuates that you're feeling that you don't belong there, because you're looking at every tiny little mistake or things that go wrong and thinking, yeah, that was my fault, I shouldn't have done that, this is why I don't deserve to be here. So it just keeps perpetuating and perpetuating every time a mistake is made. Yeah. But in reality, mistakes are made all the time. That doesn't mean that you're not good for the role. That's just human error. That happens.
Definitely. So another way that you can kick feeling like a phony is talking about professional and academic challenges to increase your awareness and show how common these feelings are. So creating an open dialogue can't banish these feelings completely, but hopefully you can build confidence in simple truths, like the scientist was saying. So truths like it's an external circumstance, truths like you have talent, you have a degree, you've worked hard, you're capable, you belong. Those are all simple truths.
I think writing down all the things that you've achieved in your life can certainly really help, because as, you know, humans, we tend to focus on the negativity bias. We scan the environment, look for things that are wrong, that are missing, or that aren't going right, instead of the things that are going right or are going well. So I think, you know, sometimes if I get clients who are talking about their own lack of self-confidence, I will get them to write down all their achievements. And it can be something like starting a new job, or, you know, finishing a year of uni, or becoming a mum for the first time. It can even be, you know, joining up to the gym, or kicking some goals that aren't big to anybody else but are big to you. Like, they're huge accomplishments, and sometimes we forget to look at our own huge milestones or accomplishment. To get through high school, like, that's amazing, and I bet most people did. To get your first job, to work really hard through uni, or if your apprenticeship or anything like that, like, that's amazing. But I think writing down your accomplishments and successes can really, really help as well.
And so can calling out the lies and limiting beliefs that you're telling yourself. So like you were just saying with the negativity bias or things that you might be kind of overthinking about, just calling that out and just being like, no, you know, that's not true. And then focusing on, like you were saying, your accomplishments and things that be simple truths. Not over identifying with your career. So your career is just one part of your life. And your career doesn't define who you are as a person.
I feel like so many people use their career as their self-identifier. And so think if something goes wrong in your career, you attach your whole value to that. Which is quite dangerous because your career is not your whole. I mean, for some people it might be, but for most people it's not.
And we measure ourselves with society's idea of success. So we're all imposters.
Like, when are we ever doing anything right? How do we know that we're doing things right?
One thing I've noticed is that we're all quite scared not to let anyone see our vulnerability, especially mentally. So we're taught from a young age never to air our dirty laundry, to hide and to be embarrassed of our struggles or our hardships. It's not something that it's normal or talked about to be like, oh, I'm really struggling with this, or I don't really know what I'm doing. Like, it's embarrassing to kind of...
Or I made a mistake here. Usually you just push that down. You don't want to talk about it.
Yeah, so teaching ourselves that it's okay to fail and to ask for help, that failing is just part of the process to a successful career, or failure is just part of the process of anything in life, really, and that it's nothing to be ashamed of or embarrassed about, and that it's important that we talk about it because that's really helpful to people, as we've discussed.
And it's universal. The more you talk about it, the more you're probably going to realize that everybody in the room feels exactly the same way as you do.
Yeah, definitely. So a successful career does not lead to a successful life. And that's why it's important to celebrate your achievements outside of work as well, and to cultivate self-confidence. So learn to take your mistakes in stride, view them as a natural part of the process, but also push yourself to act before you're ready sometimes. So sometimes we can kind of get caught overthinking before we take a leap of faith. Force yourself to start projects that you might have been planning for months. The truth is, there's never going to be a perfect time, and your work will never be 100% flawless, because no one's perfect. There's no such thing as perfect. The sooner you're able to accept that, the better off you'll be.
And no one is going to come knocking on your door with your resume being like, hey, I've read your resume and things aren't matching up.
Where have you been hiding? Scouring the planet looking for you.
The fraud police are not going to come and be like, oh, we've actually found you out.
Although it can feel like that. Like, there have been times where I've been sitting in my office and like looking out the window, like, did someone just see me? Like, they know.
As you just type you on your computer, be like, I'm just faking it till I make it.
And we all are.
We all do. I think, you know, whoever it is in your work, who is your boss, your superior, just know that they have probably also felt exactly the same as you have, and probably still tend to feel that way, because, you know, we are all just faking it until we make it. And we were saying, like, when do we ever make it? Is there ever an end point where we just make it? Is there ever an end point? Are we always just all going to be faking it? I think that's really important to know that, you know, most people are faking it.
We're all just out here doing our best.
Really, really trying. So I want to leave you with this quote regarding how the environment can impact on imposter syndrome, because I think that it is really important to take note that it's not just us that is responsible for the imposter syndrome. It is something that the environment also has something to do with. So this was a really cool article in The Guardian. I actually can't remember the author. And it says, it is crucial to remember that women are not born feeling less than, but if you're continually treated as though you are, you eventually internalize it. And this is not merely synonymous with low confidence. Imposter syndrome is a logical outcome of a world that was never designed for women to be successful. So 100% agree with this quote, but I also believe that men feel this as well. I don't think it's just women, but that's really interesting to note that imposter syndrome, it doesn't just come from us. It comes from the environment around us, especially because I think what feeds into it is nobody talks about it. So you think that you're the only one feeling it. But I think it's also the society. I think that also sets us up for a bit of failure, because we see everyone around working really hard and being successful, and you think, oh God, I'm not like that, or I did that, I didn't do that degree, or I've, you know, not climbed up my career ladder enough. You know, I don't really deserve to be here. But the truth is, you know, the environment has got something to do with it as well. But yeah, as I said, I think the same can be said for men. You know, men who have high positions, men have high expectations to provide for the family. So I think it's not just women, but men too.
I 100% agree with that. And I think there's a lot of pressure on men as well because they identify as the breadwinners of the family, generally speaking. And I think men attach a lot of value to their ability to earn an income and be successful in their career.
Men have got it really hard too. There's that really patriarchal idea that men need to earn more money or be the breadwinners and take that home. What if you're someone whose income doesn't reflect your effort that you're putting into your job? You know what I mean? Like, what if you're a really hard worker but you're not earning much money? I wonder how that would impact on men as well, and, you know, and women too. I had this really interesting chat with Josh the other week. You know, I was looking at other jobs online and I was just thinking, you know, looking at salaries and things like that. And I just said, oh, like, look at this one. You know, it earns this much money. And he was like, oh, but you'd be earning more than me. And I was like, yeah, it's the 21st century. Welcome. And he kind of joked and said, oh, well, I'm going to have to find a second job. And I was like, what? Like, there's still that the men needs to earn more. They need to provide for their family, which I think is super interesting.
Yeah, definitely.
So if you are someone who's feeling like this, please know that it's super normal. Be kind to yourself and know that you deserve to be there 100%. They didn't just give you a job for free, just, you know, handed them out. Obviously, you worked your butt off, so you deserve to be there as much as the next person. Alrighty, our favourite part of the podcast is answering your questions. Woo-hoo, Q&A time. All right, Hado, what have you got for me?
Alrighty, so got a great question from one of our friends. A little shout out to Andrew. So, what's the easiest way to get somebody talking about their mental health problems when they don't want to talk about them?
Oh, that's a really good question.
Amazing question.
All right. So, if it was for me, if I have a client who does not want to open up, which is quite normal, I will talk about other things with them. I know that sounds quite counterintuitive, but I think it takes time, and I think for me, I would never push anybody to open up if they don't want to, unless there's a high risk there.
Yeah, I'd say that's the key, not pushing and not pressuring. So, yeah, I would do that too when working in a clinical setting. But when I'm with my friends, if I can kind of sense that they're struggling with something or that they may have mental health problems, and I'm wanting to support them, I find one tactic or strategy that works really well is going for a really long drive somewhere and opening up the conversation, like you said, about other things. But then that conversation usually turns quite deep and quite personal. And when you're in a non-confrontational positioning, like sitting side by side as opposed to face to face, people tend to open up a little bit more.
Feel as vulnerable.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, if you're cruising around on a Sunday, it's a long drive, maybe a couple of hour drive, that gives them the chance to relax, to really feel comfortable with you and maybe start opening
up. So do something with them, like do an activity. One thing that I would say also, you could just state facts. You could say, hey, I've noticed that you're a bit different. You're a bit off. I noticed the other day when I tried to talk to you, you didn't want to talk to me. Or I just, you know, state your observations. You know, you probably have some stored up that you've, you know, have started to been kind of obvious. So it's kind of like, hey, I've noticed that you haven't been out with anyone in a while. Or you haven't come out with us in a while with our friends. Or I've just noticed that you're a bit off, you know, just something like that. Or, you know, anything. So stating their behavior. Is everything okay? What's going on? Is there anything I can help with? Just want to check in.
Definitely. And also stating how important they are to you. So reminding them, you know, that you're really important to me. I really care about you. And then, yeah, state your facts, what you noticed or what you've observed or even how you're feeling. You might even be like, hey, I feel a little bit distant from you. Is everything okay? Is there anything I can do to help? And then just listen. Listening, I feel, is so underrated, and people underestimate how important it is for someone to just feel like they have an ear to talk to, and how much relief that can give someone who has a mental health illness or someone that's battling with a really difficult situation. They might just need a time and space and an opportunity and someone to talk to.
And someone that wants to know.
Wants to know.
Because I think that's curious. The hard thing is just that, you know, you might think that someone who has a mental health issue, it's quite normal to feel that they're a burden and they don't want to, you know, make anyone else worried about them, or they just don't want to put that on somebody else. But I think that's really important to open up with. You're not you know, you're my friend and I would do anything for you. And, you know, you would do anything for me. So of course I would do anything for you.
And you want to know what's going on. How they're feeling. Yeah. Like, I really want to know what that's like for you. Yeah. I I really want to understand what's going on for you. Approach them with that curiosity. And also oftentimes, and this comes back like recommendations I would make if I'm working with a client who came to me with this issue or a friend would be, don't try and relate to what the person is going to by explaining how you have felt in a similar situation. For example, if you have a friend that is suffering with depression or symptoms of depression, it's not very helpful to say, oh, yeah, I get really sad sometimes too. I know exactly what you're going through. I get really sad too. Because if they are battling with severe depression or really struggling with depression, that not only kind of minimizes how they're feeling and takes away from how they're feeling, it also kind of just makes them feel like, oh,
maybe I'm overreacting to this, or maybe I shouldn't be too sad.
It doesn't actually validate how the person's feeling, and it doesn't actually give them the opportunity to express themselves.
And I think also, don't try and fix it. You cannot fix someone's problems. That's not a job as a friend or a family, whoever it is that you're trying to talk to. Just talk to them, be like, that really sucks. Mm. How does that feel? That must feel so shitty. Another good thing that also works that I have found with clients who don't want to open up is I'll say, look, a lot of people who've been through what you've been through, for example, relationship breakdown, family problems, a lot of people who've been through that generally feel pretty depressed or pretty anxious. Mm. You know, that's pretty normal.
It's a normal reaction.
So is that how you're feeling? Because, lots of people feel the same way. So it's not asking, are you feeling depressed? It's saying, hey, it's quite normal that, in this situation, lots of people feel like this. Is that how you're feeling at the moment?
Mm.
And that can take the pressure off them a little bit, that, oh, God, I'm feeling depressed. I don't want to talk about anxious or whatever it is.
Mm.
It's just like, oh, good, I'm not the only one. And this is normal
and
to feel like this.
This is a normal reaction.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. So if they're someone that's going through a really difficult situation or a really challenging situation, to just say, hey, this isn't a normal situation. Mm. So of course you're going to be feeling some pretty strong emotions right now. Of course you're going to be having some pretty strong reactions to what you're going through.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not an easy thing to do, is to talk to someone that doesn't want to talk. So do not force a conversation, because sometimes forcing it can make it worse, unless there is a risk of self-harm. Yeah. Then that's when intervention needs. But I think people will come to you when they feel comfortable. And if you're not someone who's good at talking, if you're not like, oh, I can't do the feelings thing. I know lots of guys are like, no, you don't have to talk.
Listen.
You could sit with them. You could just make time for them,
Play a game.
Yeah, like go play some footy. Go just show them that you want to spend time with them. And that can be even more powerful than words sometimes. So if they're not open to talk, just say, all right, if you know they're going through something, all right, mate, let's hang out.
And if there's someone, and obviously I don't do this with clients, I'll do it with friends. If there's someone that is being quite socially withdrawn and isolating themselves from social outings, I will often be like, hey, I really need to hang out with someone. Can I come over and chill with you? I'll bring food. And that way, even if you're not, you don't, like we said, you don't want to force them to talk about anything. Just going to their house where they feel safe and comfortable, they might not want to go anywhere, and just company, just giving them some company and room to talk if they want to talk. Or you might just sit and watch a movie and eat some yummy food or play a board game or something like that.
Yeah.
And then that might just give them the space to kind of be like, okay.
And I think activities as well, it is really good sometimes. I mean, I know with boys, to go to the pub or to go drinking or partying. I think in a case like this, it's not the best idea because drinking can actually make symptoms a lot worse and it can make that person feel a lot worse. It can make anyone feel worse. But if you have a mental health disorder, I think drinking and partying, it's kind of more of a avoiding tactic rather than...
if that's their coping mechanism.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, and people sometimes who do suffer mental health concerns, they can have quite addictive personalities. So if you're drinking or gambling or whatever it is, or partying, that can be a coping mechanism, which actually isn't very healthy. So I would tee up an activity that is a walk, go to footy together, go play golf, whatever it is, go to Bunnings together. I don't know what guys do, obviously.
Yeah. Bunnings. Bunnings is a big thing.
I love Bunnings.
Lowest prices are just the beginning.
And, you know, I think I said this in my last episode. There are so many resources out there. I'd be like, hey, man, I listened to this awesome YouTube the other day. There's so many big sporting figures getting behind mental health. Mm. You know, what do you reckon of that? Mm. Do you reckon that's pretty cool that they're backing depression? Or do you reckon, you know, just having some opening that isn't directed at them? Because when someone feels like they're targeted, it's like a deer in the headlights. It's like, oh, I don't want to talk about it. It's weird. It's weird. Mm. So just softly being like, oh, do you hear that so-and-so is, you know, backing anxiety and they're part of the Beyond Blue Foundation? Or I listened to this really cool podcast the other day where, you know, so-and-so.
It was called the Psychology Sisters. So,
really cool. But, you know, I get it. Not everyone's going to listen to a podcast, but just say, hey, I listened to this really cool YouTube on mental health that a footballer talks about. Like,
I read this really cool article.
Yeah. Like, what do you reckon? Do you think that's pretty cool? Or, like, have you ever felt like that? Mm-hmm. You know, it doesn't have to be, you don't have to be a professional at all.
No.
I think the best time to talk to someone is when, you know, they are your mates and, you know, having a good conversation with them, but not forcing it.
Mm-hmm.
I think we generally as humans like to fix it and just don't want anyone to feel sad and unhappy. But it's the best way you can help them is just to sit with them, with their feelings and be like, that sucks.
Definitely.
That's
just awful. Sitting with them, listening and
not fixing it.
Not fixing it.
No. So hopefully that's helpful. All right, guys, that is all for today. We will catch you next episode with Stages of Relationship.
Woohoo!
All right, guys. See ya.
Bye.
Thank you so much for listening. If you love this episode or you know someone who might, we would love you to share this with them. If you want to see more, please follow us on our Instagram at The Psychology Sisters.
Please note the content shared in this episode is for educational and general informational purposes only and does not replace personalised advice and support from mental health professional. See you next episode for more spicy science and sexy self-help.